House Special Committee of Ways and Means, February 27, 2006. President Representative Wilson, Representative Moses, Representative Seaton, myself. And last Friday, we had started taking testimony on House Bill 418. Well, excuse me. We continued testimony, public testimony, on House Bill 418. And the last person to testify was Steve Burrell from the Alaska Miners Association. Mr. Burrell is here this morning, and we had to interrupt his testimony last Friday. So we're going to pick up where we left off on Friday. Mr. Burrell, if you'd identify yourself for the record and continue with your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Steve Burrell. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Miners Association, and I'm testifying on behalf of the association. Thank you again for opportunity to testify. We believe this is an extremely important issue for lots of reasons. The as just to recap a little bit of what I said previously, legislatures and administrations over the past several decades have said that they were open for business, and many companies heard this statement and they believed it and responded by investing in Alaska. They invested in Alaska at a time when metal prices were very low. It was just in 2004 that they began increasing, and today we have an extremely unique point in history with metal prices for precious metals, for base metals, and for coal, all at the same time at elevated levels. This is the first time that that this has ever happened in our knowledge or in what I can discern from any time in the past. The companies that have been investing over these years, when they were encouraged to come here and invest, looked at Alaska. Initially, after Anilka, a lot of companies left the state. They felt that it was not a good place to do business. We have been working very hard, and we very much appreciate the work of the legislature and the administrations over these past many years to remove uncertainty, to improve business viability in the state, and doing that by a lot of changes that have been a benefit not just the mining industry but to many different industries. I guess from there I would just say that we clearly do not support this legislation. We believe it's a wrong thing. We believe it sends an extremely bad message. But at the last hearing, there were several comparisons made between mining and the fishing industry, and it's not our intent to in any way to bash the fishing industry. Some of the economic comparisons made it's clearly a situation of apples and oranges between mining and fishing. It's not fair for the fishing industry to be compared with mining when the mining has such high costs for infrastructure, finding the resources, followed by obtaining permits, and also typically must pay for its own infrastructure. I did a little comparison here on a few of the things that apply to both industries. And again, I'm not interested in bashing on fishing. It's an extremely important industry of the state, just as mining and oil and gas and timber, and timber used to be, it still is and can be. But the primary similarity between mining and fishing is are two things, and that's the need for people and the need for mobile equipment. Beyond that, many of the things do not compare. Baseline environmental studies, for example. Yes, there's in the mining industry many years of data. It's a sunk cost. It's a cost at risk, and that's not a cost for the fishing industry. Permitting in your large mines, the permitting cost is borne by the company themselves. There's a large mine permitting process. They pay for the permitting process through an arm's length contract with the state, and then the state literally use their people. This is based on legislation that's been passed in previous years. Of course, the focus at that time was to ensure that The state received, you know, or if you will, a company paid for some of the services it was receiving, and that's exactly what's being done right now in the large mine permitting process. From a permitting standpoint, a mine is going to require a large mine, an environmental impact statement lasting 3 or more years, plus or minus 50 different state and local permits, federal, state, and local permits. As for the fishing industry, I'm not sure if I'm sure there are a few permits that people have to have. Regarding facilities, port facilities are typically provided to communities, and yes, there are charges. Those charges to the fishermen are involved with moorage, dock fees, basically to pay the ongoing maintenance. But port facilities, for example, at Red Dog and Greens Creek in Kensington, in the case of Red Dog, the state actually went out and contracted with through ADA, and I believe the number was $105 million to build the road and port facility at Red Dog. Thus far, $208 million, I believe it is, has been paid back to the state into ADA. And, of course, all that money goes into the general fund. But as compared to an original cost of $105 million, $208 has already been paid back. The interesting thing is that Red Dog Mine, Tech Cominco, had to guarantee that they would make a minimum payment every year. So the loan, if you will, for the port, yes, it was a loan, and yes, it was done by the state, but in actuality, this was a guaranteed payback, even if they didn't have the concentrates to ship on the road or out the port. So, those are facilities that the mine constructs. Greens Creek, similarly, they have two port facilities, actually. One is where they bring the people in. A second is over where they ship the concentrates out. Roads, another piece of infrastructure that is different between the mining industry and the fishing industry. Roads at Usabelli, Red Dog, Greens Creek, Nixon Fork, Illinois Creek, they've all been paid for, and I didn't write on here, but also by POGO. They've all been paid up front before any investment began, before any return began. Those roads were necessary, and the companies have paid for those. Electricity, similarly, Red Dog, Greens Creek, Kensington, Nixon Fork, Illinois Creek, those mines all had to provide their own power. And, of course, other on-site infrastructure. Processing facilities. Typically, most fishing has a separate processing facility. It's a sales, a product is sold. In the mining industry, there is almost always a processing facility of some kind on the mine site that the miner has to pay for ahead of time. I guess the whole focus here is to say that this is clearly apples and oranges and the comparisons are not between the two industries are not I don't believe are logical. Some other comparisons that have been made at times have been between Alaska and British Columbia or other Canadian provinces. I didn't have opportunity to dig into it, but my own experience in the coal industry in Alberta and the lower 48 states, the city of Grand Cache, Alberta, and I'm thinking this was the late 60s when it was built, but and again, don't quote me on the numbers, hold me to the numbers, because again, it's just I haven't been there for 25 years, but the road, which is about 80 kilometers, the railroad, the city, the power, all of these were put in place in the Grand Cache area, which was about 80 kilometers north of Hinton, Alberta. They were all put in place for the purpose of creating new jobs and providing the infrastructure for both for timber operations and for coal mines. Smoky River Coal operates in that area, and so that infrastructure was built by the province for there. The other one, which is more recent, was in northeast British Columbia. It would have been in the late 70s, early 80s. The British Columbia government, I'm not sure how many hundred miles of railroad they put in, but it was more than a couple hundred. And if my memory serves, it was in the vicinity of $700 million was put in. It was either 9 or 11 major tunnels, a couple of them over a mile long, to get this railroad into an area where there were going to be two new coal mines. And so that infrastructure was paid for by British Columbia. Another comment that has come out in the discussions has to do with foreign companies and foreign ownership. It's surprising that issue would raise itself, and that would be considered as a criticism of the mining industry. You know, the foreign investments, when they come to the state, be they from whatever location, they provide jobs here, supplies and services are typically purchased here, and for the mining industry, very definitely, the jobs are here. It's very difficult for people working at a mine to not live in the state, not live in a local community. Supplies and services are purchased here, equipment's here, and of course taxes and such, local taxes especially. I look at the converse side, which is U.S. firms investing in other countries. We are, of course, we're in a global marketplace now and a global community. U.S. Oil and gas firms typically dominate the industry wherever you go. ConocoPhillips and ExxonMobil are operating all over the world. A huge number of smaller companies the same way. We celebrate when a U.S. company is operating in a foreign country, providing expertise. In the case of Vico with its operations in Canada and Russia and the Mideast, all around. I don't know the name of the company, but there's a company in Fairbanks that provides plastic pipe, and they sell it in all over Russia and primarily in the Moscow area. I look back also at the way in which some states fall all over themselves to attract a Toyota manufacturing plant or a BMW plant for their local areas. I guess the most recent was the competition for Lufthansa and for KAL in the Pacific Northwest. Where are these airlines going to be based? Where are they going to use as a hub? And so again, it's hard to understand why anyone would want to criticize foreign investment in Alaska. Conclusion: I would say that there are a whole lot of differences. We're clearly looking at apples and oranges between Alaska and other other jurisdictions. We believe that passage of this bill, even out of this one committee, would be an extremely bad thing. It would not be understood by the industry, and it would have a very negative effect on it would be bandied about in other jurisdictions as look what Alaska just changed the law on taxation. They turned it upside down after 20 plus years of stability. Now they've pulled the rug out from under the companies, and so with that, we urge that this committee not pass this bill. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Burrell, questions for the committee? we're joined by Representative Roekberg and Representative Grunberg. Representative Roekberg.
Second Chairman Weinrock, Mr. Burrell, Morning, sir.
Good morning.
Could you expand on your last statement about the, were this committee to, you would move this bill out of here, that would send the wrong message? I mean, because of, it would be a positive pro-tax action by a legislative body? Is that what you're getting at?
Mr. Rookberg, through the chair, yes, it would. It would be seen in some, let me say, we are in a extreme competition right now with British Columbia for funds. Yeah, within British Columbia, there is a thing called pass-through, a pass-through taxation such that if you are a British Columbia resident and you invest in a mining company and that mining company invests in British Columbia, you treat that investment that you made in that company as a as an expense on your taxes, a flow-through charge, if you will, to decrease your taxes. And so the pressure on companies, I mean, and these are the companies that primarily come to Alaska or are looking at Alaska, these folks are up against an extremely high hurdle to say, well, okay, now why is it you're investing our money in Alaska? We don't get flow through when it goes to Alaska. And so investment monies that would potentially come to Alaska, you can bet that there would be people within British Columbia that would say, aha, looky there, Alaska just, they're passing the tax change. You don't want to go there. You want to invest your money here.
Mm-hmm. Representative Wilson.
I guess, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would you explain that a little bit more? Because don't most companies get to deduct their expenses, but only if they're making a profit? At the beginning, I know there's a lot going on that you don't make a profit for several years. So can you explain to me how that works in Alaska now compared to what BC is?
Representative Wilson, through the chair. I'm talking about you and me as individual investors. The companies listed on the stock exchanges, they raise money through the stock exchange, and you and I or whoever invests in those companies. It's not the company. The company, it becomes an expense, yes, but it's you and me as investors that take it off of our personal taxes. It's not the company we're dealing with. It's the way the law is written in British Columbia. It's that the individual investor in the company gets a flow through. And it wouldn't work for Alaska, obviously, because there isn't a personal income tax in Alaska. If there was a personal income tax in Alaska, then a flow through kind of a thing could even be considered then. Is that?
Just follow up. So in other words, that same person that gets that deduction in BC just because of their income tax wouldn't get one in Alaska because we don't have an income tax.
That's correct, and they're a resident of British Columbia, first off, and they, of course, they live there, they invest there, and so it's to their personal advantage to see the money invested in British Columbia because they can immediately take it off their taxes as compared to some of the companies that that want to invest in Alaska. It's another hurdle that they already have to cross to bring investment money here.
Representative Seaton.
Yeah, on that point, so, but you're not talking about international investment other than British Columbia. I mean, anybody else going into British Columbia is faced with the same situation they have anywhere else. I mean, only a person that's a resident of British Columbia that has their, that is a resident there receives that benefit for that investment. Is that correct?
Mr. Seaton, through the chair, there is a national Canadian also flow through, and I'm not acquainted with exactly how it works, but there is a portion of flow through. If you're anywhere in Canada, you invest and it stays in Canada, and there's also. And I know that British Columbia and I think Quebec has it, whereas if you are a resident of that province and the investment monies is actually expended in that province, then you get a secondary benefit too. In other words, the details of which I don't know. I'm been on the fringe of it.
Yeah, And I guess just to follow up that, I just want to make sure that we're talking apples and oranges here. You're only talking about Canadian companies. You're not talking about any of the other worldwide investors in mines. Is that correct?
Yeah.
They're the only ones that would profit by that particular Canadian or particular province structure of their tax.
I believe that's a correct statement. I'm not sure of that.
And in response to that, are the companies that are wanting to allow those investors leaning towards using LLCs or sub-S corporations in Alaska so that they do pass the taxes through and so that they're not paid in Alaska?
I have no idea. I don't know anything about LLCs or...
Representative Greenberg.
Thank you. Mr. Burrell, good morning.
Good morning.
Let me make sure I understand you right. A Canadian investor would be able to take a deduction on their income tax. Is that correct?
Correct.
We ought to lure them to Alaska where they wouldn't, if they lived here, they wouldn't pay a dime in income tax, shouldn't we?
Actually,
your argument, we should lure them to live in Alaska. I like your argument.
Mr. Grunberg, through the chair, we're talking about investors now, typically, not individual workers. I mean, we have a lot of Alaskans that want to go to work, and the industry does everything it can to find those Alaskans and put them to work, especially those in their local communities.
Representative Wilson and Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Burrell, I have, of the different mining investments in Alaska, are there several of them that are Canadian?
Through the chair, yes, ma'am.
And what percentage would you suggest?
Well, the Canadian consulate did a study recently, and I don't recall the number, but did they brief legislature on that? It's a huge number. It's over 50% for sure, over 50%. The United States has basically run the mining industry out over the past couple decades. The attacks on the federal mining law, nothing to do with Alaska, but the attacks on the federal mining law and the extremely stringent environmental requirements, and not just that you have environmental requirements in place, but there's so often a punitive style of a requirement. Those things have basically run a lot of companies off. There's been a consolidation throughout the world in many, many industries. The oil patch, we've seen that, of course, but in the mining industry also, whereas, for example, Homestake Mining, which mined for 130 years or so at South Dakota, was merged, purchased, if you will, by Barrick Gold. Other companies have similarly been merged, and so we just don't have the investments coming from the United States that we did at one time.
Thanks, Representative Wilson. Representative Seaton and Representative Roper.
This bill looks at two things. One is the production, the other is changing the royalty, the percent of gross. And I was wondering, you know, within Alaska, we've got our state-owned lands, which is where royalties apply. And I'm just wanting to get your comparison with the other lands in Alaska. That's the Mental Health Trust lands, which includes Fort Knox. And that includes Red Dog, which is with a Native corporation. And, you know, we've had testimony that if we do a net smelter return, we're going to kill the industry. And can you let us know what the net smelter return rates are that are paid by the current mines that are being developed to those private landowners within Alaska, and how much more that is than the state of Alaska gets on its lands?
Mr. Seaton, through the chair, you know, I don't know what those numbers are, and we'd need to look at each project, say, but Red Dog, for example, is on, yes, it's on private land. We only have five large mines in the state. Usability Coal, Greens Creek, Red Dog, Fort Knox, and the newest one, Pogo. And so now Pogo is the first purely state land that we have a mine operating on. I'm not sure you can characterize those differences. One of the points of, if you will, of Red Dog in particular is that that project, that mine is probably one of the highest grade mines in the world. I mean, of its size, and that's an extremely unique situation at Red Dog. And for that matter, it has been able to jump all the hurdles to become an operating mine. I don't know the one thing I picked up though from what your question was I look at there are three parts to the bill, and the third one is the investment incentives portion, eliminating the investment incentive portion.
I'd like to follow up.
Can we pause there a minute?
Sure.
There's a number of questions. Representative Seaton.
Just following up on that, I mean, you know, the purpose of this bill is to make sure that Alaska and Alaskans, as we're required to under the Constitution, get a reasonable return. We've had testimony that if we change, say, our royalty rate, that we're going to kill all the mines in Alaska. And yet, the information that we have is that the royalty rates, and the testimony has been that a net smelter return royalty rate will kill every mine in Alaska. It's got to be on a percent of the net. And yet, the big mines that have been developed in this state recently, you know, we're talking Red Dog, we're talking Fort Knox, have been on private land, and they had net smelter return rates higher than this bill proposes. And so since those are the mines that have gone forward, I'm asking the industry to try and give us some comparison here why it is they're willing to negotiate significantly higher rate net smelter return rates than this bill proposes for state land, for private lands, and yet they develop those. And that they say that if we do a net smelter return royalty at a lower rate than they are privately negotiating, it's going to kill every mine in Alaska on state land. And I want to understand why, you know, their mining industry is willing to negotiate those royalties with private landholders for these big mines, but they're not. They're saying it's going to kill it on state land.
Mr. Seaton, through the chair. First off, I have not heard anyone make the statement that an NSR would kill all the mines in Alaska. I'd be interested to find out who made that statement, because that's not one that I would make.
NSR is net smelter return.
That's right. Because every project is very, very different. And yes, indeed, Red Dog, I presume, has, and I don't know this, but I presume they have an NSR. But, for example, Greens Creek does not have an NSR. Fort Knox does not have an NSR. And Pogo doesn't have an NSR. So I'm at a loss to know which mines are on private land that have negotiated an NSR. I don't know which ones you're talking about.
Well, let me ask you. Is Pogo on state land?
Yes, sir, state land.
Is it native land or
state? No, state land.
Is it mental health trust land?
No, sir, it's state land.
Just pure straight land.
Pure straight land, state land.
Are there any distinctions between the tax rate that's assessed against a mine and the lands that they operate on?
The mining license tax is the same for every operation, irrespective of land ownership. The production royalty is strictly against state land. If you're on state land, you also pay the production royalty. If you're on state land, you also pay a rent, a claim rental, which escalates over time, over the period of time you have the claims.
Representative Wilson, you had a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would you go over again which mines are on which lands?
Okay. Red Dog is on Nana Regional Corporation lands. Those are private lands owned by the native peoples of the Northwest Arctic. Greens Creek is on federal land. They're federal mining claims and private land. Some of the claims have been patented. Fort Knox is on mental health trust lands. and Pogo is on state land. And those are the only, those are the only five mines in Alaska that have, that have 100 employees or more. I mean, it's... Oh, yeah, that's coal, yeah. UC Belly's on state land entirely, yes.
What is the distinction between exploration and development? When does a mine end absolutely? Is there a bright line between exploration and development?
Basically, construction. When you go into construction, that's... And different jurisdictions in the world will treat it slightly different, but from the standpoint of the state of Alaska, for they've been saying, okay, exploration is up until such time as you have all your permits in place and you start building facilities. Development then is could be equated to construction of facilities, and of course operations following on.
So does a mine get a piece of paper that say they're in development and not in operation?
No, a mine, excuse me, under the mining license tax, it defines the break point at which you have all your permits in place to start.
And do the people know that to begin with?
Oh, yes.
Check sheet, so you once the last box is checked, you've received all your permits, then you're ready to construct and you're in the development phase.
Well, it's people don't really, that's not really an issue for people. You know, if you can jump through all the hoops to get your permits, you're very pleased to start construction typically. And
I understand. What I'm trying to understand, though, is the most expensive part in terms of overhead, it seems to me, maybe not, but is exploration, where you have to go through the permitting process, you have to go through all these studies, you have to go through all the environmental analysis, you have to go through the litigation, you have to go through the infrastructure development, the roads, you have to build your generators, you have to get your gear on site, you have to get your cars there, you have to get your railroad laid, whatever. That all happens during exploration.
No, sir. That would happen. you're mixing slightly between exploration and development, because let's say in the case, let's look at Kensington. They've begun construction now, but previously they had a camp in place, they had a road up to the site, they had an adit driven into the mountain, they had developed entries off of that adit to do bulk sampling and everything. All of that kind of work, because until they make the decision that they can build a mine, that it's economic to build a mine and go forward, that's where the development starts, when they make that, if you will, that construction decision.
But that also then is after all the permits.
Well, they have to have all those permits in place to make that decision.
But in the case of Kensington, and this is, I'm trying to probe what the distinction between, say, if you have a production percent of production tax that kicks in and under a mining license tax, is there a time, a point where you can say we're not in exploration anymore, incurring those costs and overhead, we're in construction and development right now? Because Kensington doesn't have all of its permits. It doesn't have its 404 Clean Water Act permit, for example. But it's constructing.
It did have that permit, and it was withdrawn, and they stopped. So we're talking a technicality there. But, no, they had all their – they didn't start constructing their facilities until they had all their permits ready. I mean, that's from my understanding.
Thank you. And Mr. Chairman, I just want to see if we've got some confusion here. There's nothing in either the mining the current tax or the proposed tax that differentiates on exploring and construction. Is that correct? I mean, what this tax is based on after production starts. It's actual mine value minerals after everything's come out and you've got ore coming out that's being paid for. Even if it's being warehoused, it isn't on site, it doesn't get taxed. It gets taxed at production.
Mr. Seaton, through the chair, I'm not positive how that last piece fits together, but basically the statement's correct that my understanding of the bill, it focuses on production and not on exploration and construction, except for the piece that removes the investment incentive. The investment incentive, and if Mr. Chairman, if I might make a comment on that.
What portion of the bill is that?
I don't have a copy of it here, but Basically, the way it...
Just a sec, Representative Seaton, you know, so we can see that.
Yeah, you have a memo there. We were requested to take where that was in section...
15?
Section 15.
Okay, thanks. Go ahead, Mr. Burrell, sorry to interrupt.
Yes, sir. The investment incentive has done exactly what we hoped it would and what the legislature, I believe, hoped it would, and it was very interesting, the debate at that time. I spent some time with Governor Knowles, who was governor at the time, and there was this question that had been raised that this was going to strip out any revenues that the state was ever going to get from mining. And I made the statement that it would be many years before any project that could potentially get a benefit from that. It'd be many years before that happened. And if I'm not mistaken, I don't think any company, this is what, 10 years ago this thing was passed, I don't think any company has yet been able to take advantage and receive a benefit from that expiration incentive. It is a, and if you just, if you strictly look at it from the standpoint of the time value of money, it does not cost very much at all, because if we're talking an investment that was made 10 years ago and the company today doesn't yet have an ability to take advantage of that, it, more than anything, it's an encouragement to companies, not a strong thing, and to stop it now, to me, is very, very wrong.
Representative Roper, do you have a question?
Oh, yes, just a clarification on a few things. Number one, Mr. Burrell, just by way of background, I appreciate the listing of the various projects here and some of the history. It seems to me that you're exactly right, that like Pogo is the first major mine that's come online in the 12 years I've been in the legislature. And I find it very interesting to see no company has used the expiration credit provisions. And could you tell the committee approximately how long it takes to get both state and federal permits to bring a project online now? And comment on the failure rate of the projects like Misty Fjord, AJ, and problems at Kensington now, and the length of time we're talking about?
Mr. Roper, through the chair, one of the slides that I often use in presentations describes the permitting time, and let's work from the most recent back. Pogo took, to get through the environmental impact statement process, took 3 years and 1 month. It was considered to be a fast process, if you will. During that period of time, the actual design of the mine was changed significantly. Initially, there was the plan was to have a shaft, and the change was to say, no, don't use a shaft, but use three declines into the ore body instead. That change decreased the footprint of the surface footprint of the project. So it had benefits from that standpoint. So that was 3 years and 1 month. Kensington is another very good example. Kensington has been through the environmental impact statement process 3 times. There was an initial environmental impact statement that took over 2 years, and I'll be conservative because it was well more than that. Then by the time it was completed, the price of gold had gone down sufficiently such that the project was no longer economic. And so after a couple of years of trying to figure it out, they came back and said, okay, we can make these changes and we can try to make the thing economic again. And so they went through another 18 months to do a first supplemental environmental impact statement. By the time it was completed, guess what? The price of metal had gone down and it was no longer economic either. And it wasn't until the most recent round and major changes in the design, including the addition of the of the property on the Berners Bay side up around Jew Allen area where they'll put the facilities, and they've made lots of different changes. They said, okay, we think at the lower price we can make it, we have a project here. And so they went back and, again, another 18 months to do another supplemental environmental impact statement. And as the chairman said, they were in construction, they got shut down, they pulled the permit back, and we're hopeful to start back up soon. But all I can say is that when that project's finished, we need to give Dennis Wheeler a prize of some kind for stick. I mean, he's the chairman of Coeur d'Alene Mines. We need to give him a prize of some kind for determination to stick with that project. And it is a very good project. But
one of the things Representative Roakberg said is, maybe I misheard him, is no exploration credits have been used. Is that right?
That was my statement. Okay. Yes, sir. I put it this way, you would want to talk with the Division of Mining or someone, but there have been credits that have been certified, but to my knowledge, no company has ever been able to, in computing their taxes, to say, oh, yes, I can now take off these dollars that would otherwise be due. And that, let me just say, that investment incentive bill was, that in itself was a major undertaking to try to put something together to craft it for the state and for the industry.
Let me ask the sponsor then, were the exploration credits portion of Section 15?
Mr. Chairman, the exploration credits were against the mining license tax.
Okay.
And so since the mining license tax was repealed, then everything that applied to the mining license tax no longer applied.
Okay.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
And it doesn't mean that you could not, I mean, of course, any that were certified ahead of time would still be applicable, I'm sure. I mean, under law, and there's nothing that would keep them from being put
in. Well, I'm not sure that if we repeal the law and they haven't been taken or applied to, I don't think they would survive. So, Mr. Burrell, I was getting in my question, too. You talked about the EIS and some of the permitting, but, I mean, Kensington's been ongoing for 12 years, and POGO wasn't 3 years. It was substantially longer than that. What in terms of starting and to getting to a point of where it's sanctioned for investment?
Mr. Roper, through the chair, the years I was talking about are the specific periods of time in which they were working on an environmental impact statement. So there were typically many years before that exploration was taking place, that design was taking place, and the company was pulling their stuff together to say, hey, does this make sense? Does this project work? What's it going to take us to, what is the permit applications basically? What do we have to do to begin the environmental impact statement process? Yeah, that takes years and years before they ever go into the, quote, technically the environmental impact statement process.
So right now your testimony is that it could take literally decades, if not generations, to bring a project to fruition, and then now we're going to be removing a tax that hasn't even been applied to any projects here in Alaska that was enacted 10 years ago. Really interesting. And Mr. Chairman, if I could go on, I guess I'm very concerned that, you know, in the last decade, the legislature has spent substantial efforts in creating the exploration credit taxes and put substantial money in the geophysical aerial mapping, which has been a matter of policy of the legislature to enhance investment and development of the mining industry in Alaska. Plus, we made some small steps, very small steps, that we're trying to work on the permitting aspects of it. But so I guess I'm quite concerned here that, you know, if I could see any real substantive progress in the narrowing this window of development, so it would have a net present value positive on investment and jobs in the state, I might be more amenable to looking at the government take situation here. But I don't. I just think we're going in the wrong direction here as a matter of policy. Until we can constrict that time to more a reasonable time for discovery, development, and execution, then a more reasonable tax, I'm not sure I can support, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson and Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. right now with if you're telling me that the incentive tax has never been taken advantage of, I have two questions. One, is it because they haven't made enough profit to be able to do that? And then that's one question. And another question is there a difference whether you're on mental health trust lands or native lands or state lands? Is it more profitable for a company on one of those lands over another?
Madam through the chair, I don't really know the exact answer to the last piece of it, but the tax is actually the reason no tax has been taken is that no project has got far enough along yet to be in operation to have a tax, to have a credit. Pogo will be the first one, I believe. Pogo and Usabelli, in that they have moved their operations, they may be close to having an ability to take it. And I, please don't take my comment to say that I'm guaranteeing that no one has taken the tax. There may have been someone, but last time I asked, they didn't have that information. They didn't think anybody had. But the reason is, but the time period, as Representative Roekberg points out, is so long that even if you were working back at that time, you're not yet in a place. You're not yet in production. And Pogo is the only one that's newly in production that has a chance to take a benefit from that. And okay, and so how can you take that? Well, the investment incentive credit is actually can be applied against mine license tax and state royalties if you're on state land, and it can be applied against corporate income tax. But so if you if you're not in operation, there's no way you can take that. And in no year can you use up more than 50% of the tax that you're required to pay. If you're required to pay $1 million and you have a money license tax credit, you could reduce your tax burden by $0.5 million. But in no year can you wipe the whole thing out. It was an extremely well thought through process when that was put into place. Very well thought through.
Just follow up, and I don't know who to ask this for, but I would like us to find out the answer. Is there a difference for a mining company? Is it more advantageous for them to mine, depending on who owns the land? And I would like to know the answer to that, because we're talking about state land here, right? And so before I can make a decision, I'd kind of like to know, is there a difference in to the mining companies, and how much of a difference?
Mr. High, I would like you to come back and after we're done with Mr. Sure. Morrell. I know you've been madly doing this back there, and I want the benefit of your testimony again. But when Mr. Burrell is finished,
I don't know if you can characterize it which is better or worse. I know that during the Clinton administration, nobody explored on federal land. Okay, that's a flat. I mean, if you already had a prospect of some kind, maybe you continued looking at it, but. It's only right recently, and Representative Wilson, from your district especially, it's only within the past, 4 or 5 years that people have begun looking again on Forest Service lands. And so there are a lot of factors far beyond who owns the land, I mean, far beyond the reasons of individual amounts of royalties or whatever that affect political stability and, you know, all these matters. For that matter, from a political stability standpoint, if you're looking at parts of the world right now where there's all kinds of unrest, including Indonesia, that's a real advantage. And we tell people that. So you don't have to have guards. You may have to have a bear guard, but you don't have to have guards with M16s to protect your people in the field in the United States and in Alaska in particular. So the factors are huge. They're all kinds of different things considered. And probably the biggest one is the individual deposit itself. What's the grade? What's it cost you to operate this? All those things are huge, huge issues that probably overweigh anything except security of your people.
Representative Seaton.
Yeah, thanks. I believe you were passed out a, if not, I'll get it to you on tax detail, that in 2003, under the mining license taxes, there was $2,568 taken as education credit on mining license tax and $29,736 was taken on the Alaska mineral exploration credit. So in 2003, there was $29,000 credit taken. There wasn't any in 04 and 05, but I think that's in your packet. So, oh, it's not. Okay, yeah. We'll provide this one for you. It goes through the credits that have been taken on oil, gas, and fisheries, as well as the tax.
Or gravel pits or something that might qualify.
Further questions of Mr. Burrell? Yeah, Representative Seaton.
Yeah, I had a question, and that was, actually, I probably should have asked Mr.
Van Nieuwenhuizen.
The other day, because he was talking about one of the differences between Alaska and BC as being the energy cost with BC Hydro, and that was the important factor. And I'm curious because we've also had, we've been working on the Four Dam Pool and a line going from Representative Wilson's district over to BC to supply electricity. And of course, that electricity, unless it's subsidized by the Canadian government somehow, is going to be at Alaska generation prices and Alaska prices. And does that mean that we should either forget putting in that line because nobody will use electricity, or that if we do that, Canada will somehow make it work? I'm trying to figure this out, because I was saying that is the big why we can't have a tax structure in Alaska that gives a reasonable return to Alaskans was based on the electricity prices, and yet the line, if we do it going over there, is going to give them the same kind of price, if not higher, than we're charging here.
Mr. Seaton, through the chair, I don't know what the economics are of that. I guess the only thing I'm sure of is that the line's not in there and hooked up yet. And okay. So, if we see it in the reasonable future, I'll be very, very pleased. And if it's economically beneficial for power to flow in that direction, it'll flow in that direction. If it isn't economically beneficial, it won't go in that direction. It might come back this way. I mean, we have excess capacity in the Four Dam Pool, and so the incremental cost of selling that power is probably pretty minuscule, so it should be some extremely low priced power. I'm not out of my league. I don't know the details of that at all.
Representative Wilson.
I do know a little bit about that, and I do know that if that happens, it will, everybody that's connected with that grid, which is us clear up into South Central, their prices will go down for electricity. So, I mean, it's a big advantage for us to be able to do that if we can, because it will help them, but it'll help us too, all of us that would be connected with that grid.
Well, I guess, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess what I was trying to get at was that his testimony, and I was hoping that we could get some response here, was that the reason the tax structure here couldn't be kind of equivalent with some of Canada's was because Canada provides infrastructure and provides cheap power, and that if we, all of a sudden, because Alaska power is higher, so we have to have our tax rates lower than BC. So I was just trying to figure out if we could get any information on that. So thanks.
Right. Other questions, Mr. Burrell? Mr. Burrell, can you try and participate telephonically and listen in? In case we have questions, we can grab you when you're on the phone. Next time we take this bill up.
Okay, sure will.
Thanks. Mr. High, can you come forward? Just for the benefit of folks, we're going to adjourn at 10. Sorry, if you'd introduce yourself again for the record. please.
Thank you. My name is Rich High. I'm Vice President of the Council of Alaska Producers and General Manager at Greens Creek Mining Company.
The reason I wanted you to come forward is I wanted you to comment on anything that was said or correct the record if it was somewhat iffy from your perspective.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to comment on a couple of things. One, I would like to state categorically that I did not, and I didn't hear Mr. Van Nieuwenhuizen say that that any NSR tax will kill the mining industry in the state. I don't recall that being said at any time in any discussion.
NSR, so, just for the record.
Is net smelter return.
Thank you.
As proposed in HB 418. I would like to comment on a couple of things, and Steve mentioned the investor side of the concerns from a net smelter return, and maybe I'll comment just for a moment on the company side. When a company is looking at investing in the state or in other states or wherever they invest, and we as a company model our performance, and as anybody does in the time that you are evaluating a project, you model life of mine, whether that's 10 years or 30 years or whatever, and all aspects of what you model goes into that calculation: production, operating costs, capital costs, smelting and refining charges, and obviously, of course, all taxes go into that calculation. And if you take a look at a net smelter return tax as compared to a net profits tax, that reduces, a net smelter return tax is comes off as a tax, reduces the net income, and it raises the hurdle for a project to be developed if you are seeing a comparable tax at one point in time. As metal prices drop, your net smelter return tax makes the project more difficult to be approved. So from the standpoint of looking at it from the company standpoint versus the investor standpoint, is a net smelter return does not account is a tax that is a regressive tax that the mining industry, and I assume other industries, prefer going to a net profits tax versus a net smelter return tax. So in the modeling process, that's what's looked at in evaluating a project. I think the question came up as to what are the fair market value appraisals on federal lands. As we talked about on Friday, Greens Creek has, for some parts of its lands, federal lands, has a net island return. It's similar to a net smelter return, but it also has it's based on varying metal prices, which is a little bit different than what we're seeing here. At lower metal prices, the percentage of the net island return is either very low, or and then as metal prices rise, the net island return rate may increase slightly. I can't remember the numbers off the top of my head, but I believe it's 0.75% up to about 2.5%, if I remember correctly. So that is one method that's used, and that was by the Forest Service, and it was negotiated on the lands that we're involved with on Admiralty Island. If I can talk a bit
how much more testimony do you have?
1 minute.
Yeah, sure.
I'll make it 1 minute or less.
Then can you come back Wednesday?
I can try and be here.
Or listen in.
Yeah. Okay. And I'll just mention that on other lands that my company is.
Just a minute. We do have some folks from the agencies, Revenue and DNR, that are online and here for questions. We will have questions on this, so if you could come back Wednesday, we'll take you up then. Thank you. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Okay. Other properties that the company that I'm involved with is looking at on federal lands are looking at it as a negotiated item. Fair market value of the property, looking at paying for potential minerals up front, and also looking at a net smelter return type payment for the metals that are involved with that property. It is our intent in the properties that I'm familiar with to try and steer away from net smelter returns in negotiating on federal lands, but with other, it's essentially an open negotiation thing.
All right, cool. Questions for Mr. High on the testimony?
Aye.
Yeah, Representative Seaton and Representative.
Net smelter return is basically after the minerals are processed and comes back to the point at which you're basically shipping it, takes transportation off. Is that correct?
I don't understand the net smelter return as it's described in House Bill 418.
Okay.
As far as, but the net smelter returns that I'm familiar with are at a point of beginning of transportation.
Right. And what just 418 talks about a mine mouth value, which allows the company to also subtract your ball mills, your processing on site, in addition to the deductions that are allowed under a net smelter return. So would that, a mine mouth value that allows you to deduct the cost of preparation of ore for shipment, be advantageous, or would that be less attractive to you than a net smelter return?
Well, it would be more attractive. Okay. It would be more advantageous from the standpoint of a net smelter return that starts at, you know, transportation. But it's still a, you know, a pre-tax, it's still a one pre-tax versus post-tax calculation.
Representative Rutherford.
Yep, Mr. Chairman, sir, I was trying to understand, did you say net island return, or what was the term of art you used?
The term that Greens Creek has with the U.S. Forest Service is called a net island return. It's just semantics.
Words. Right.
N-E-T.
Yes.
A net.
Yeah.
Yeah, net, net island.
Island, so island. Return.
Okay. Just trying to clarify for the record.
Right. Correct.
And then the your testimony is that you can negotiate with the U.S. Forest Service. So are there certain parameters that federal law or regulation give the agency to actually have the foresight to negotiate different things?
Well, I'll apologize for not being able to answer that question completely. I was not involved when the net island return was negotiated for Greens Creek. That was in the mid-90s.
Sir, you just said that you're working on something else, though. So you're
there's other projects in the U.S. that that our parent company is involved with that are on federal lands. And I know that it's a topic of discussion as to whether to look at payment for those lands. So I see it as a negotiating item that benefits, you know, both parties as best as possible.
So it would be fair to say that when dealing with the federal government, there's some flexibility on their part to deal with a private firm. Is that correct?
I believe that to be correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay.
And I want to conclude.
Yeah, I just had one other follow-up. I missed the net island return or that royalty portion is not being used now because you're not out from your main source. Is there a federal royalty paid on the main portion of Greens Creek?
No.
Okay.
All right. Committee is adjourned until Wednesday at 9.
Thank you. Thank you.